This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. From the days of the Kodak Brownie camera, images have been all around us. But it seems like today there are more than ever. Some of us look at computer screens all day. Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and other apps bombard us with imagery, some of it solicited, much of it not. But our visual brains didn't evolve for that kind of pinpoint focus.
Dr. Sheila Reeves will talk about the topic tomorrow night in Sheboygan as part of the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences Academy Talk Series. Reeves is a professor at UW-Madison and a member of the UW-McPherson Eye Research Institute, and we reached her via Skype from her office in Madison. Reeves explained what she hopes to impart.
I think this talk in many ways comes from my early questions when I was a beginning news photographer in photojournalism. I was one of the first women to join, you know, daily newspapers and go into the arena of competition and trying to scoop the other guy. And I always wanted to know what makes a good picture. Because you could kind of always know a great picture, but I wanted to know what makes a good picture. And no one can really ever answer that.
Have you found out?
Yes. What I did was transferring into academia, and during the 1990s, this has gone back a while now, but in the 1990s, President Bush called the 1990s the decade of the brain. And I love that, because what he recognized was that you could have invasive procedures that could see the brain in real time. And it was the functional MRI technology. And you could see the brain lighting up when it was interested in something. And so what neuroscientists initially did, for the most part, is study the visual brain. And that's a metaphor. When I say the visual brain, it's really the visual system. And it just goes throughout the brain because we're such visual creatures. But when I started to find out what neuroscientists were talking about, it became this wonderful adventure for me, no longer to answer what makes a good picture, but to answer what attracts the visual brain.
So basically what you're talking about is what the brain wants to look at.
Yes, yes. And actually, I cut it down even more because there are so, visuality, the notion of we being visual creatures is not new. It's scattered throughout communication, through art history, artists, photographers. We know pretty much how visual we are. What I wanted to learn about was what biology and science could talk about those first 2 seconds of visual awareness, or what happens before we're visually aware. Because as a photojournalist, that's what we're trying to do, is to see what attracts quickly the audience. And neuroscience was one way for me to answer that question.
So what is it that catches us? Is it motion? Is it color? Is it shape?
Yes, it's really actually what you mentioned. What I think applies to what catches the visual brain is, first of all, our visual system is evolutionary in terms of keeping us safe. And so what the visual brain first wants to do, and you see this when you walk into an unfamiliar building or a place, you are looking around and you're looking differently. You're doing visual searches that are different. It's not just about directions and where can I find a parking space. What we're trying to do is to make sure we don't miss something that could potentially be a problem, like, you know, lion in the grasses from where we evolved. We're trying to defeat camouflage. And so in the first really 2/3 of a second, 600 milliseconds, we're trying to make sure there are no faces that we're not aware of. We're trying to get an idea of depth. And we do this with color and with lines. So the first thing that the visual brain does is to defeat camouflage.
That's such a wonderful phrase.
Yeah.
You know, just the concept of that, because yes, it's something I think in the military you call spatial awareness.
Yes.
Where you need to know where the danger is.
Yes, that's right. People in the military or in police, they want to get a visual. You know, we need to get a visual to confirm X or Y. And we're doing that all the time, too. We're getting a visual. And the first thing is answering what the emotional brain is always answering is, first, am I safe? And we answer that with a visual affirmation.
How closely, and I know this probably is a little outside of your research, but how closely does the visual work with our other senses to determine whether we're safe or not?
One example that, and the course that work that I teach to my undergraduates, I get a sense of what students are responding to. And students love it when we combine things like color and typical foods like lemons, in that lemons are supposed to taste yellow. This is not my research, this is my finding, again, the impact of, that color has on the visual brain. And we use color for both depth. Color gives us a sense of depth between subjects or prey, because we evolved from people who hunted their own dinner and made sure they would not become dinner for something else or for someone else. But color has powers that go even to our foods and the foods of presentation. And lemons should taste yellow. If you color them purple, they don't taste like the normal lemon. And so we're bringing in color into that feedback loop that includes sight and taste.
You're making me think of synesthetics, you know, people who combine senses in ways that most of us don't.
That's right. And I've spoken about that, too. And finding out from some of the neuroscientists, we were lucky enough to have V.S. Ramachandran come visit us many years ago. And he spoke to a full audience and he talked about synesthesia. He did research on synesthesia and it answered personally the fact that in synesthesia, you can have letters or words have color to them. So maybe the letter 7 is yellow whenever someone comes across that. And that's that notion that parts of the brain that fire together will wire together. And what Ramachandran and all the neuroscientists talking about synesthesia was that people who are synesthetic are also very creative and they're very good with metaphor. And I really enjoyed that because the artists in the room all enjoyed or were proud of being synesthetic because it is associated with being a little more creative.
Well, and you talk about artists and the title of your talk is The Art of Vision, as opposed to, say, the science of vision.
Yes.
And I wonder, when we first see, do we have to be taught how to see, to interpret what we see, or is that something that is just innate in us and eventually it all makes sense?
You know, so much of understanding the brain is coming from people who don't have certain attributes. And so some of it is based on people having to cope with terrible things that might happen to them. And so when people who have been born without sight from the beginning, and then the few that have received their sight, what their problem is that they cannot figure out which space, which plane of focus is important. Whereas when we are sighted and we are, children are doing this, you know, as they're toddling around, they are negotiating space and what lines are important and what planes of field are important. So someone who suddenly is thrown into this chaos of blooming, it's been described as the blooming, buzzing chaos. Yes, we have to learn that very, very early on. And so infants are, you know, bedazzled, if you will, with all of the lines and objects. They're learning that. They're learning which are important.
Does science support the idea that where we are born and what culture affects how we see, or is that it does?
Yes, it does very much. And this came out of visual anthropology, really, in that, and it comes with depth. There was a visual anthropologist who went and studied the pygmy people, and they live their entire life in very dense jungle. And they have a wonderful culture and a successful culture. But when you took for example, a pygmy elder out into the savannah, he did not know the biological rules that many of us have in this country, especially, that as something goes into the distance, it shrinks. Okay, and we call this relative size, that if you have a car up front, it looks very large. And as it goes into the distance, it just gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And we assume this is like normal, right? Well, it's cultural. It's not that it's normal, it's that it's cultural. And many cultures around the world, it will take a while for children to learn that rule. It just depends on where they were. But if you grew up in a thick forest, you would not have to develop relative size. And so going back to the pygmy elder, this elder, very smart, didn't have to develop that notion that things are small the further away they are. So when he saw buffalo in the distance, he thought of it as strange insects. He did not associate it with the buffalo that were close by. And so what I love about the visual brain is, first of all, it is shaped by culture and it is shaped by autobiography, and it is always changing. And that's the great adventure of saying visual communication and being visual is important to me. So at any point in our life, we can start to learn this and we can extend how much we see in this world, how much color we see, how many lines, how much depth we see. And I find in our overly multitasking society that we now have, where our life is so much lived on the screen, the flat screen in front of us, I actually think it's kind of nice to look around our daily, ordinary world and just enjoy being visual.
Me too. I'm one of those people that refuses to engage in technology when I'm out walking.
Yes.
Because I want to look at distance, and I want to look at different colors, and I want to sort of absorb the world as I'm perceiving it at that moment, rather than through a screen.
And actually, what you're talking is kind of a visual mindfulness, what you're doing on this walk. You're not talking to a friend or family. You are being present. And we know that with mindfulness studies, I was at a talk with coaches who were teaching mindfulness to medical students, because medical students, with all that they have to do, can have increased chances for depression. And she, as a mindfulness coach, would go outside and she would look at the sky and look at the clouds and find faces in the clouds, which in Wisconsin is probably easier when it's May or June. And suddenly the world of clouds, they're beautiful. And you can see faces because we have in our visual brain, we can't turn it off. We want to find faces, whether they're false or not, doesn't matter. It's an adaptive skill that we want to make sure we know about, again, all of the faces that are in our landscape. So we project faces where there aren't any faces to be had. So I have some slides for that, which is usually fun for an audience.
Well, you bring up something interesting. What about seeing things that aren't there or being fooled by what your senses are telling you?
Right.
I'm thinking specifically of parachuting. And the sensation of you jump out of the plane at 10,000 feet and you are falling very, very fast towards the earth. But the sensation when you look down is that nothing is moving.
Wow.
And it is the strangest thing. You'd think that the earth would rush up towards you, but it takes a long time before it does. The only sense of falling is if you feel the air going. There's no sense of the earth getting closer. And so your eyes are obviously, something's happening there where your brain can't process what's going on.
Your brain's not processing motion because the brain did not evolve jumping out of planes. That's about the best thing that comes to mind, is that our brain evolved from having to process and track prey, say running, you know, running an animal, a dinner, potential dinner, running across from left to right. And this potential dinner was such a common sight for our ancestors that we have particular eye movements that can anticipate and track that, which is why so many people enjoy football. We're very good at tracking the football. Well, I'm not. I always
I was going to say I'm not either, but that's
no,
all right.
You know, all of the fakes, I always follow the fake, you know, play on that. But if you're good at it, there is a pleasure in tracking things that are moving left or right or up or down. We are good at that. But in terms of jumping out of a plane, I think it's going to take a while before maybe you get that really efficient motion processing. I think that when I was a sports photographer, I think one of the things that I was just sensitive to motion. And so I could anticipate where the athletes were going ahead of time to be able to catch that decisive moment in sports.
Well, then what about, and this kind of goes into law and the idea of being a witness to something, mm-hmm. and where people are convinced they see a certain thing, but it's later proved that they did not see that because it didn't happen. Has the neuroscience kind of caught up to what's going on there?
I think what you're talking about actually are memory studies and the notion of false memory versus real memory. And that's out of my field.
Okay.
But what your question really does point to how fascinating neuroscience is, and in all the different arenas that people are hungry to look at neuroscience and try to apply it to a real aspect in life. And that's what I've been doing in my class, which has created lectures that this talk is about, is that it is what can neuroscience support our personal biology in the brain that can make us enjoy visuality and images and be better at communicating or be better at appreciating art or be better walking in our own world and enjoying the daily miracles that are all around us. Just taking it in. And I think that being present is being visual. I really feel that, you know, when you're really super busy, you don't see much. Scientists know, I work with vision scientists here at the university in terms of trying to resolve blindness. They are, not me, but I talk with them often. And what they're trying to do is to kind of go against nature in that the older you get, the less we see. And yet, the older we get, science is finding out, we still have plenty of brain plasticity in order to see things and learn new things. Into our 70s, we have new neurons that are formed if we're doing, you know, enough exercise and things like that. But one of the things that I'm realizing is that our world can get smaller as we age. And I don't know about you, but I don't want that to happen to me.
No, I certainly don't. I want to be out looking at everything.
Yes,
all the time.
Right. That's right. And you're so good at it. And going back to those first 2 seconds of the visual brain is that we are so good. We can't turn off face seeking, which is why you can see faces in clouds or you can see faces in a mop or in the grain of wood. You know those times when you hey, that looks like a face. Well, you can't not see faces if the pattern is close enough to you. We're good at color and lines and trying to defeat camouflage by seeing a figure from a background. We can't turn that off because it is about being safe. And we can use these strong biological processes that work so fast, it's so transparent. We can use this to then enjoy our daily world, enjoy the windows of our life, the windows of a restaurant, those kinds of things which add, I think, visual pleasure.
Yeah, I was going to say it completes being alive. You know, you
yes.
want to absorb as much of it as you possibly can.
Yes, that's right. And so I think part of the pleasure of great movies, the cinema photographer or the photojournalist, is they spend their life trying to figure out what attracts the visual brain and how to best photograph something. And we get spoiled by this. I want to be able to apply, you know, the visual talents that I see in movies and television and in photojournalism. I want to see that in my real life. I want to live deeply in that regard. And I think that our screens feed us so much that we forget that. We forget our visual power. And that's what I want to remind people in Sheboygan.
And I'm so glad you talked with us about it today, Dr. Sheila Reeves. It's such a pleasure to virtually meet you.
Virtually, yes, that's right, Bonnie. Thank you so much. And I'm so glad that you are walking around enjoying your world without a screen. I think that's great. Keep at it.
Dr. Sheila Reeves is a professor and director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison and a member of the UW-McPherson Eye Research Institute. She'll talk about her work tomorrow evening at the Meade Public Library in Sheboygan. There is a link to more on her talk at WUWM.com.